Mildred and Richard Loving began dating when they were neighbors living in Virginia. He was white, she was of African American and Native American descent. Shortly after they got married in 1958, they were arrested in the middle of the night for defying Virginia's ban against interracial marriage. The ACLU took their case and eventually argued before the U.S. Supreme Court challenging Virginia's anti-miscegenation laws. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously for the Lovings in their 1967 groundbreaking decision. The Lovings didn't seek the spotlight, nor did they see themselves as civil rights activists. Mildred said she was an ordinary black woman who fell in love with an ordinary white man. Today in Radio Times, we remember the Lovings and the legacy of Loving v. Virginia. We have two guests who join us by telephone. Kevin Noble Millard is an associate professor of law at Syracuse University, author of a forthcoming book to be called Loving v. Virginia in a Post-Racial World. And Kevin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, same to you. Robert Pratt, also with us, professor of history at the University of Georgia, teaches courses in U.S. Southern and civil rights history. He knew the Lovings. In fact, he played with their children, Sidney, Donald, and Peggy. And Robert Pratt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and happy Valentine's Day to you as well.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, and good morning.
And good morning. And Robert Pratt, if I can begin with you, you knew the Loving family. You knew Mildred and Richard Loving. What were they like?
They were very fine people. When I first met the Lovings, actually, I think I probably met the children before I met them. But over the years, I came to know all members of the Loving family. I did not know Richard that well. I really didn't know him that long because I didn't really have that much time to interact with him, given his untimely death.
Right.
But
killed in a
car Richard
accident.
Was just an average guy. I mean, he was well-known in our community. He was really well-known throughout several communities, but especially in Caroline County, where he grew up and lived most of his life, and in Essex County, which was the adjoining county where he spent a good bit of his time. But, you know, he knew everybody in the community, and people knew him and sort of accepted him, really, as one of us. I had known Mildred Loving and other members of her family, especially her sister, for many years, as well as the children. They were ordinary people, and I think they'd be the first ones to tell you, as they had persisted for many years, that you know they didn't really set out to make history. They were just plain people who just got caught up in some pretty historic events.
Indeed. Well, I mean, and I have to say, when I read about them talking about themselves and what they wanted, it's so simple and, frankly, so beautiful because, Kevin, they say, we loved each other and all we wanted to do was live together as a married couple.
Absolutely. And then how they were caught was quite interesting because after they got married in Washington, D.C., because they couldn't get married because of laws in Virginia that prevented people from different races from getting married, so they go to D.C., come back to Virginia, and in the middle of the night, the police came in their house and said, who are you? You know, who is in bed with you? They were asleep at the time, and all they were doing was just sleeping. And then, according to the state of Virginia, that was a crime into itself. So, you know, even just cooking, taking care of their children, driving to and from work, doing whatever it was, that was seen as this huge political act just because she was African American and he was a white man.
Well, Kevin Millard, if you could, and we can't shoehorn all this history into our discussion today, but looking at the law in Virginia, the law that made it a crime for people of different races to marry each other, how many centuries back does this law go, or did this law go?
It was actually only in 1924, and interestingly enough, it was part of a eugenics movement. Eugenics, which would just be the science of human breeding, right? These people should marry each other, and then we'll have a really great population. And we've heard that before in Hitler's Germany. And so in the state of Virginia, all of these eugenicists and lawmakers got together and said, this is what we need to have, a really strong population, a really strong white population. So the law itself, the Integrity Act, was to keep the races separate, but only white and everybody else. So it didn't matter if someone was Mexican marrying a black person or someone who was Asian marrying someone who was Native American. Virginia didn't care at all, just as long as they married a white person. And then that's when Virginia said, you're not allowed to get married.
Well, Robert Pratt, let me go back to you, because as we know, there was sex, there was rape parts of Virginia, parts of the South, parts of the country where there were plenty of mixed race people. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, well, you know, Virginia, as much as the country, it was nothing new about interracial sexual liaisons. And to follow up on the point just made by your other guest, this whole eugenics movement, part of this Racial Integrity Act of 1924, and as the point was made, you know, really, there was no restriction or prohibition against other races marrying each other as long as they were not white. So what was often referred to as the Racial Integrity Act really only was concerned about the integrity of the white race. Really, it did not matter about other races. But with respect to interracial sexual liaisons, they had been going on ever since, sure. I guess, the country was founded.
Indeed.
And so it was really nothing new about that. And I think in certain quarters, they were even accepted as sort of the way that people did things. And so, but what made the Loving case different was that Richard and Mildred wanted to have the right to live together legally, lawfully, as husband and wife, and that's what sort of set them apart from everybody else. I mean, if you look at the interracial mixture and the cultures in much of Central Virginia, where you have a very interesting mix of Caucasian, African American, and Native American cultures, there was a lot of interracial mixing, but it was all done under cover of darkness. And so it had the sort of tacit approval of the community, but only when you began to bring these liaisons into the light of day and try to give them legal sanction did you run into difficulties.
And Kevin Millard, just to add to our conversation here, then there was the one drop rule, talking about quote unquote racial integrity. How was that a factor in this, for instance, Racial Integrity Act?
So the one-drop rule is really interesting. So it would mean that anyone who has any black ancestry at all, no matter what degree, even if it were 1/512th black, right, back, you know, 7 or 8 generations, they would be considered black, even if they looked like Heidi, right? Blonde hair, blue eyes, they could still be considered a black person. And any knowledge of that racial ancestry would invalidate any marriage to a white person. But in Virginia at that time, everyone that was not white was anyone that had any drop of blood that was black, that was Asian, that was Latino, anything, except for anything that was American Indian, because in Virginia, the first families of Virginia, there are people that like to say, we're descended from Pocahontas. So they made something called the Pocahontas exception that said, anyone with Native American ancestry, but it has to be very remote, can still be considered white, because people like to go around and say, yes, I'm a descendant of, you know, these founding people of Virginia, of the United States, but I also want to still marry other white people. So there was that exception there.
Well,
and this
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that this created a multitude of ways that black people could look, right? Black people with different skin colors, different eye color, different textures of hair. So there was just not really any way to see who was black and who was white, but the law still held this mysterious law in place nevertheless.
Robert Pratt, let me go back to you and go back to the Lovings. And I got the feeling that when they got married, they were not fully aware that their marriage was illegal. Am I reading that right?
Well, I think there's been some ambiguity there, and certainly I think you may get different responses based on who you talk to. My sense of it was that Mildred, who I knew for just about all of my life, was a pretty shrewd individual, and some have made the argument that they didn't know that interracial marriage was prohibited in the state of Virginia, and I suspect they may have used that sort of as a cover. But it's hard to believe that they did not know, because one would have to wonder why they would have traveled about 90 miles to D.C. To get married when they could very easily have gotten married in Virginia. So you almost have to think that they knew, and conversations I had with Mildred over the years, she never really came out and said that they knew they were acting in defiance of Virginia law, but it was pretty clear from some of the things that she said that I think they understood that they would be better off if they got married someplace else. So I think they clearly understood the implications of that aspect of the law. What they were not sure of, and what they were, I think, surprised to discover, was that under the Virginia anti-miscegenation statute, not only could whites and blacks not get married in the state, but they could not attempt to circumvent the law by going outside of the state to get married somewhere where the interracial marriage was legal, but then come back to live as husband and wife in Virginia. That's the part of the statute that they were not aware of. I think they knew that they could not actually have the ceremony performed in Virginia. But once they've traveled to D.C. and became married, they certainly expected that when they came back to Virginia that they would be able to live as husband and wife. But that is, of course, that's the part of the law that they were not clear on.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Mildred and Richard Loving, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled eventually in their favor in their case in 1967, essentially saying that it was okay for interracial marriage in this country, okay being not a particularly legal word, a very important case, Loving v. Virginia. Talking with Kevin Noble Millard. He's an associate professor of law at Syracuse University, author of a forthcoming book about the Lovings and this particular case. Robert Pratt, a history professor at the University of Georgia, knew the Loving family. And we're going to take a very short break. Open up the lines for any questions or comments you might have. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Atlantic City Convention and Visitors Authority supports WHYY and presents the 4th Annual Atlantic City Restaurant Week, March 4th through 10th. Food lovers can experience ethnic, gourmet, seafood, steakhouse, or casual restaurants. There are dozens of locations providing a variety of dining selections. For more information, menus, reservations, and a list of participating restaurants, acrestaurantweek.com. Sponsored in part by a grant from the New Jersey Division of Travel and Tourism.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY? We want to finish our winter membership campaign today, and that will only happen if you call 1-888-345-9499 or go to WHYY.org and make a pledge of support. What are all the programs and services that you enjoy and rely on worth? You decide. Again, make that call at 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks very, very much.
supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Cayley Group, presenting How the West of Ireland Helped to Save Illan Bagpiping, an informative talk by Dr. Scott B. Spencer, featuring Ivan Goff. The lecture takes place on Saturday, February 18th at 3:30 p.m., followed by an evening concert with Ivan Goff and Eamon O'Leary at 8. Both lecture and concert take place at the Commodore Barry Club. Tickets at PhiladelphiaCayleyGroup.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Mildred and Richard Loving didn't see themselves as political activists. They simply loved each other. They wanted to be married. But back in 1958, their interracial marriage, he was white, she was black, was a crime in their state of Virginia, their home state of Virginia. They were arrested, kicked out of the state, and the U.S. Supreme Court eventually took their case and ruled in their favor in 1967, the case Loving v. Virginia. Talking with Robert Pratt and Kevin Noble Millard. And I do want to play a clip from a report, an ABC report, where Mildred Loving describes the night that they were arrested. And let's listen to what she says.
It was about 2 a.m. And I saw this light, you know, and I woke up and it was the policeman standing beside the bed. And he told us to get up, that we was under arrest. And anyway, they carried us to Bowling Green and locked us up. And in January, they had the trial. And they told us to leave the state for 25 years. But the way I understood it, the lawyer said that we could come back to visit, you know, when we wanted to. So that Easter, we came back and they got us again.
And that was Mildred Loving talking about the night that she and her husband were arrested because of their interracial marriage. Again, talking with Kevin Noble Millard and Robert Pratt, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Kevin, if I can go back to you, and picking up where Mildred describes the fact that she and her husband were arrested, they appear before a judge in Virginia. What does the judge rule?
So the judge says that you are not supposed to be together at all. Why? Because you're of different races. So he has this really kind of, I guess you could call it famous or bizarre or super discriminatory quote that says, God did not intend for the races to mix. That's why he put Malay, African, European on different continents, and they were never supposed to come together. So, of course, with a judge with an attitude like that, they're not going to win in Virginia at all. So then they try in the federal court. And this eventually went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which and they won, and this is how we are able to freely marry who we want racially right now, according to our own choice. And the Supreme Court had two different issues that they talked about, and one was an equality issue. People should not be treated differently because of their race, and it wasn't fair in Virginia for whites to be able to have their racial integrity preserved, and then the racial integrity of everyone else was not preserved. And plus, the Supreme Court said that that law was just to promote white supremacy. And then the second ruling was on a due process issue, which is about fundamental rights. So the Supreme Court wanted to say that marriage is a really important civic duty that people have, a really important center of family life, and to deprive people of their own choices would be violative of their own due process rights.
Robert Pratt, let me go back to you. I'm actually looking at an excerpt of a letter that Mildred Loving actually wrote to Robert F. Kennedy, who was the Attorney General of the U.S. at this time, and this is back in the early 1960s, appealing to him after these court decisions for help. What did she say to Robert Kennedy?
Well, you know, for a long time, when Mildred and Richard left the state, after being banished by the judge, they spent several very unhappy years in Washington, D.C. And I think they took it for about as long as they could. And then conversations that Mildred and I had over the years, she explained to me that clearly this represented probably the lowest point in their lives. They were married, but they could not live in Virginia with their family and their friends, and so they had to endure this exile. And she had been talking to several relatives of hers, and someone suggested that, why don't you contact the Attorney General, which is what she eventually did. And she wrote to Robert Kennedy in her own handwriting. She had a very beautiful handwriting, something that she would possess until arthritis began to take a toll on her. But she said very clearly that she wanted to be married. She was married, and she wanted to have the right to live with him in the state where both of them had been born and where their children had been born, and she just thought it was terribly unfair that she could not do this in the state of Virginia. And so she implored him to do whatever he could to help her in her hour of need, as she put it. He responded and then referred her to the American Civil Liberties Union and eventually, as you know, two attorneys, Phil Hirschkopf and Bernard Cohen, would eventually take the case. But, you know, for her, it was a matter of decency and of basic fairness. And I think if you got to know the Lovings, you would certainly know that Mildred was by far the more assertive of the two. I think, but for Mildred's intervention, they may well have stayed in D.C. a lot longer before mounting any kind of legal challenge. But Mildred was the kind of person who felt that something had to be done. And so she really was sort of gutsy enough to take on that initiative.
Yeah, and the letter is, again, you know, straightforward. She says what she wants.
Yeah, straight to the point.
Straight to the point. No,
yeah.
And obviously
yeah.
It worked because Robert Kennedy gets the ACLU involved. And Kevin, if I can go back to you, you mentioned that the arguments that were made before the U.S. Supreme Court, they did take this case for free, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
absolutely.
As a way to challenge what Virginia's anti-miscegenation laws, but also other anti-miscegenation laws in other states in the U.S.
Yeah, because at the time there were 16 states in the United States that outlawed interracial marriage. So then, if it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court says anti-miscegenation laws are unconstitutional, this would mean that no state at all would be able to enforce their own anti-miscegenation laws, which did not work immediately. So little by little, states started to invalidate their own laws. There's a little bit of self-policing there. But then even today, right, as recently as 2 years ago, there was this justice of the peace in Louisiana that said, I'm not going to marry this interracial black-white couple because I just don't believe in it. I mean, he can't prevent them from getting married because it's absolutely unconstitutional, but there are all of these lingering discriminatory acts. And interestingly enough, in Alabama, it was only in the year 2000, only 12 years ago, that they finally took their anti-miscegenation laws off the books, and it only won by a very small margin.
Wow, what does that tell us?
I think that it's interesting because, as Professor Pratt was saying, that people can interact with each other all they want informally, but when it comes to the law recognizing that, people have a different approach to it. So some people would say, well, this is tradition in Alabama, or we can't enforce these laws anyway, so why change it? Because if we change this one law, this is going to open up the doors to a lot of other types of marriages now being able to be valid, like same-sex marriage or polygamy or marrying your, you know, sister, you know, or whatever this whole litany of marriage prohibitions might be.
Robert Pratt, could you describe, because you lived in this town where the Lovings lived, and it sounded as if Mildred Loving lived there, and Richard Loving had to sort of go in and out of the town in the darkness of, or in the cover of darkness. I don't want to be overly dramatic here, but can you describe how they tried to at least get around the laws?
Well, certainly, between 1958 and 1963, for about 5 years, the Lovings were under this banishment decree. Now, after they began, once they contacted the ACLU at Bobby Kennedy's urging, their attorneys were able to get, a temporary injunction, which would allow them to stay in Virginia. So they were able to come back to Virginia sometime in the mid-60s before the Supreme Court ruled in their case. But between 58 and 63, they were not supposed to be in the state. Now, under the terms of the banishment, they did have the right to return to Virginia to visit family and friends, but they could not be caught in the state at the same time, and they could not travel as husband and wife. So, in effect, the banishment decree meant that the Lovings had to travel to Virginia separately. And so, on many occasions, Mildred would come into Essex County with the children. And Mildred would, at this time, because they lived in Caroline County, I actually grew up and lived in Essex County, which is next door. And this was on these occasions that I would see and play with the children. Mildred's sister, Garnet, rented a room in a large boarding house that was owned by my great uncle.
Oh, wow.
And when Mildred and the children would come into town, she would visit with her sister Garnet. That's where they stayed, and so the kids would come out, and we would play, and sometimes we'd play all day long. And from time to time, around the edge of dark, we would see this car come in from the other direction, a car that I later learned was owned by Richard Loving. He would come in because there were two ways to get to this house. There was a sort of a main entrance off the main highway, and then there was a side road, and he would come in on the other direction. And there were occasions I would play with the kids, and this was before I knew who he was. And I would play with the children, and I wouldn't really see him, because whenever he visited the house, he would always stay inside. You didn't see him walking around. He would park his car around the back of the house. And so it wasn't until I would go inside with the kids to get some water that we would actually see him. And so I would see this man, and when I went home in the evening, I would ask my grandmother, I said, "Grandma, who is this white man that I keep seeing up that up there with Garnet and Mildred?" And of course, my grandmother, everybody in the neighborhood knew, but I was a child, and she says, "Well, that's the children's father, Richard." I said, "Oh, that's who he is." But it was on those occasions that I would see him. But he was, I guess you could say, a fairly permanent fixture in our community. People knew him, and they accepted him, and I think they respected both him and Mildred for what they were trying to accomplish. He was accepted as one of us and one of the people in our community.
Well,
those were some very interesting times.
I can only imagine.
Here I am as a 7-8-year-old child. I have no idea that I'm watching this dramatic historical event unfold right in front of my face, and I'm actually a part of it.
Well, and Kevin, I mean, so you have the law, and then you have, you know, in a sense, what people were actually doing in this case. And I'm not laughing because it's funny, but it's just, it shows the sort of the unwieldiness, the impossibility of these anti-miscegenation laws.
Absolutely. And this occurs even today, right, where you have same-sex couples living together, people of different races living together, couples that live together without being married and having children. And there are all of these forces that are against them. But when you look at people's practical, everyday lives, it's really interesting to see that the law prevents any official recognition of the ways that people actually live. So then the law is supposed to say, well, this is the way we want people to live, but that doesn't really affect people's hearts, because it could say, well, we're going to not allow you to get married. So then this is going to say, this person is not your official spouse. So then you can't inherit from them if you die without a will, or you can't claim them on your health insurance, or you don't have any other legal privileges because you're not married. But then the people are choosing to order their lives how they like it, and that's a lot of times very different than what the law has in mind.
Well, let me even quote from one of the attorneys, Cohen, part of his argument he made before the U.S. Supreme Court, Kevin, really underscoring what you just said. And he said to the court, the Lovings have the right to sleep at night, knowing that if they should not wake up in the morning, their children would have the right to inherit from them. They have the right to be secure in knowing that if they go to sleep and do not wake up in the morning, that one of them, a survivor of them, has the right to Social Security benefits. All of these are denied to them, and they will not be denied to them if the whole anti-miscegenation scheme in Virginia is found unconstitutional. And Kevin, it was a unanimous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the end.
Absolutely. And then I think that speaks really strongly as to how important this was, because there was no division on the court whatsoever. And I think that it could be interesting if we had a similar issue today with same-sex marriage. Would there be a split court? I think there definitely would be, you know, because we have different figures on the court now than we did 45 years ago. But then having all of them come together and say, this is a really important issue, it cannot be interpreted any other direction, is a really great start of saying, denying people the right to choose who they want to live with, who they want to have families with, and having the state recognize that is a really, really important issue.
And Robert Pratt, going back to you, once the U.S. Supreme Court made their decision, where did the Lovings live?
Well, Richard, for many years, I think most of his life, his main form of employment was a brick mason. And he had always said he wanted to build a home for his wife and his family. I mean, things that we tend to take for granted now. I mean, any man, self-respecting husband and father, wants to be able to provide for their family. And this, of course, was a right that had been denied him for so long under the Virginia's anti-miscegenation statute. The fact that he could not be with his wife, he couldn't acknowledge her, he had no legal standing over the children, who under Virginia law were considered bastards. He just, and of course, not being able to provide for his family. So things that we take for granted meant so much to him. And so once their marriage had finally been validated by the Supreme Court, they returned to Caroline County, where they had been, and he was finally able to build that brick house for her and the children. And so I think it was certainly a moment of triumph for them, for those of us in the community. The Lovings, of course, when they were asked if they wanted to attend the final proceedings at the Supreme Court, they both declined. And the only message that Richard had to send to the justices, he said, was tell the court that I love my wife. And it is a shame that I cannot live with her in Virginia. Again, very simple, but yet very, very powerful and very poignant. It sort of cuts to the heart of the essence of this case.
Absolutely.
It's just about, this is my wife, and she and I have chosen to enter into this holy union, and it's just a shame that I can't live with her in Virginia.
Well, let's hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and that's Robert Pratt joining us with Kevin Noble Millard, talking about Mildred and Richard Loving. We do have some callers I want to get in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Bryn Mawr College Performing Arts Series welcomes the famed John Jespers Company for a one-week residency culminating in the world premiere of Fort Blossom Revisited, 2000-2012, a reworking of Jespers' legendary Fort Blossom. It's a personal look at the body and how we experience it, both as owners and spectators. Open to the public in the Hepburn Teaching Theater in Goodhart Hall, Friday, February 24th through Sunday the 26th, 610-526-5210 or brynmawr.edu/arts.
I'm Artie Moscowain, and I'm going to be shameless. It's my birthday today, and since you didn't buy me a present, how about making a pledge of support to WHYY in support of Radio Times? It sure would make me happy. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. That's WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, Type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. Mildred and Richard Loving got married in 1958. Shortly after that, they were arrested in the middle of the night for defying Virginia's ban against interracial marriage. The ACLU took their case, and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously for the Lovings in their 1967 groundbreaking decision. This being Valentine's Day, we are talking about this love story and obviously the legal fallout as well with Kevin Noble Millard of Syracuse University and Robert Pratt of the University of Georgia. Gentlemen, I do want to get a couple of callers in who have been waiting very patiently. We have Doreen from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Doreen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had to call because last year, some of my family, we've been doing some serious research into our ancestors, and we learned that our great-grandmother was from Caroline County, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, she came to Philadelphia, but when she died, she was buried back in Milford, which is a small town in Caroline County. And she was an extremely fair woman, to the point that my grandmother, she looked white. And we always had this story that her name was Ellen Allen. We always had this story that she had an assignation with a white man. Now, we've not been able to find her grave. We know that having gone down there last year and a very, very wonderful trip, the library in Caroline County was just wonderful to us. There were a lot of Allens that lived around there.
But well, you know what, Doreen, only because you raise an interesting point, and it gets us back to Caroline County, Virginia, which
right.
is, of course, where the Lovings spent much of their time. And I want to give Robert Pratt, picking up on what you said, but also connecting us back to this story, which is that this was, in many ways, Robert Pratt, a mixed race county, that there were blacks and whites and others that were living in close proximity.
Yeah, let me get to the caller.
Sure.
If she's still online, and to ask if you say your grandmother?
My great-grandmother.
Your great-grandmother. Do you know if she, what race did she consider herself to be?
Now, when she came here, what we have found in the census, she was considered, a Negro, or she was not considered white. And she had two children who were extremely fair, and one, of course, was my maternal grandmother. So we know, and I am aware, that in that area of Caroline County, there was an awful lot of mixing going on, just like you, I believe you had said earlier,
yes,
a lot of natives were intermarrying with blacks and whites and so on and so forth.
Doreen, thanks. Go ahead, Robert.
Let me speak to this. That first of all, you say that your great grandmother was from a small town called Milford. Well, that's where Richard and Mildred lived.
Wow.
That was their actual mailing address, Milford, Virginia, which is just about 25-30 minutes from Bowling Green. But it's Caroline County. But they actually lived in Milford. That's their address. And of course, for many years, they attended St. Stephen's Church. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with St. Stephen's Church, but there are many people in that area, some who would consider themselves white, many others who would consider themselves part Native American and certainly African American, St. Stephen's Church was the church where many people in that neighborhood actually attended. And if you're still in search of your great-grandmother's grave, I don't know if you have checked St. Stephen's Church or not, but I would not be surprised if someone there could be very helpful in terms of helping you make that connection.
Oh, that's great. Doreen, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and Robert Pratt, I'm sure that's very helpful. And Kevin Millard, if I can go back to you, and I talk about this Loving v. Virginia as a groundbreaking case. Is it also been a forgotten case, do you think?
I would definitely say so, and I actually wrote an entire book on that entire subject, that specific subject, because I think most of, when we think about civil rights, most of the case attention goes toward Brown versus Board of Education. And so when I talk to my students, like I'll talk to my students this afternoon at 2:30, and when I talk about interracial marriage law, most of them don't even know about this case until we go over it in class. Or if I talk about it with my friends or people on the street or cab drivers, people have no idea the names of the people. They don't know about Richard or Mildred Loving. They don't know that it's only been 45 years since interracial marriage has been legal everywhere in the United States. But I think the interesting part of this is that even though it might be legal now, there's still not really a flood of interracial marriages as one might think. The whole fear of many states saying, well, if we had marriage being legal between the races, then everyone's just going to suddenly, you know, cross the line and be down with the swirl, so to say. But then I don't think that that is the way that society has gone, because people still live in relatively segregated communities, and the only place where people might meet might be in college or in school, but people still have fairly separate lives, and then their families themselves at the most intimate level are still relatively segregated.
And we're almost out of time here, but I want to make sure, Robert Pratt, that we know what happened to the Lovings, and tragically, he was killed in a car accident. She died in 2008. What did she die of?
Well, very briefly, if I can, to sort of follow up on a point made by Professor Millard, is
sure.
That certainly I think the Lovings have sort of been, and their case, has been victimized by the way we tend to bookmark the civil rights movement. We tend to begin it with 1954 Brown v. Board, and we end it with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so civil rights activists and pioneers who were instrumental in the movement before 54 and those who were involved after 65 have sort of gotten a brush to the periphery. I think that's what happened with the Lovings. And, of course, the fact that they were not in themselves, they didn't see themselves as activists, they didn't really go out and wave flags and draw attention to themselves. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why their case, unfortunately, has been relegated to a footnote.
Right.
But Richard Loving was killed tragically in an automobile accident in 1975, broadsided by a drunk driver.
Oh,
Mildred died a few years ago of complications from breast cancer. Her middle son, Donald, died suddenly in 2000. He was 41. Her oldest son, Sidney, who was my main playmate, died from lung cancer last year. So the only surviving member of that nuclear family of five is the youngest, the daughter Peggy. So we would like to think and hope that these love stories have a happily ever after ending. But very tragically, the Loving story did not end that way, and they really did not have very much time to share any marital bliss. It is a very tragic story in so many ways, but I don't think you could find a more powerful love story. And the fact that the Supreme Court decision that ended the ban on interracial marriage has their name Loving,
indeed,
which I think in and of itself is a most fitting irony, I think.
Well, I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us today on Radio Times. Robert Pratt, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And Kevin Noble Millard, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with assistance from Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.
And you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Good morning. I'm Joanne Allen, and I'm joining Radio Times host Marty Moscowen in asking for your support on this, our last day of the winter membership campaign. The number to call is 1-888-345-9499, 888-345-9499. And Marty is joining me, and we're asking for you to help us to make a goal this hour, Marty. It's $10,000.
$10,000.
I think that there are at least 10, there are at least listeners out there who want to contribute to help us to make our goal on this program that you cherish, that you listen to, Radio Times. Again, the phone number is 1-888-345-9499. Also, you can pledge online. Let's hear that ping at WHYY.org.
In fact, we hope this to be the last day of the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. And that will happen, of course, with your pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499. We just did a show, Joanne, about the Lovings and Loving v. Virginia. Yeah. We thought that was an appropriate discussion to have today on Valentine's Day. My birthday, Terry Gross's birthday, Dave Davies'
birthday. Birthday to
you. Didn't get me a present, so why not make a pledge and make sure that Radio Times meets this goal at 1-888-345-9499. This is
Marty.
Fun. This is fun.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
If you want to give Marty Moscowen a happy birthday present, do so with a call to 1-888-345-9499. Marty, I know that you take a lot of time and effort to prepare your show. I actually see you preparing it. You're here at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, getting ready to go on, and you take all of the time that you need. You do your homework here. You do your homework at home. You're always working on the show, and I think listeners need to understand that and also support that kind of effort on the part of Marty Moscowen, 888-345-9499.
And actually, it's part of what Radio Times does. And frankly, Joanne, we have the time on Radio Times to get in depth, to get to know guests, to bring people in who we think are interesting, to host debates and conversations about some of the important issues of the day, whether focusing locally or nationally or internationally. There's so many things to talk about. And frankly, we feel very lucky on Radio Times that we have the place, the time, and the listeners who support information and news like this. We live in a complicated world, and it takes time to dissect things, to pull them apart, put them back together. That's what we do, or certainly try to do, on Radio Times. That's why you listen to WHYY more than just Radio Times. Think of all the programs and services here at WHYY. It's all there for you, and the role that you play is to make a pledge of support. You decide what it's worth. It's $100, $1,000. $10, we don't care. We just want you to make that pledge at 1-888-345-9499.
As you know, Marty, it's all about community, the community of listeners who join us as broadcasters in making sure that WHYY has a strong future. Let's successfully reach the goals of our winter membership campaign. We can do it with your help. I'm pretty sure we're going to do it with your help. You got to make the call right now at 1-888-345-9499. Also, pledge online at WHYY.org.
In fact, we have folks from Resources for Human Development, also from Ready, Willing, and Able, who are ready, willing, and able to take your phone call. We love to make those phones ring, and it's not just to make us feel good, but it also tells us that what we do on the radio matters to you, that you have thought about some of the things that we have been able to talk about on the radio or on the web or podcasts. There's so many different ways to get your news and information, and WHYY, frankly, provides all of that. For me, it's an invaluable source. I wake up to Joanne Allen. She's on my radio when I get up in the morning. And through the day, you have all sorts of people, some of whom work here, some of whom work at NPR and other programs across the country. It all comes together here at WHYY. That's worth your pledge of support because you're listening. 1-888-345-9499. And as Joanne says, if you pledge online at whyy.org, we'll hear that ping.
And we're about a third of the way through our goal for this hour. It's a very modest goal, actually, $10,000 for this hour of Radio Times and Marty to carry the Mutual Admiration Society bit a little bit further. When I'm done with my newscast at 10, I can get up and leave the room for the first time in like 6 hours.
I bet.
But I often sit there and listen because of the subject matter that you have on your program, because of the interviews that you do, because of the guests that you have on. I find myself still stuck sitting in the chair. I'm like,
sorry.
Get up and go. If you're someone who listens to Radio Times and you appreciate what you hear, let us know now, because this is the last day of the winter membership drive, your last opportunity to pledge during Radio Times. Let Marty know that this is an important program to you. How do you do it? Well, you make a phone call or you ping whyy.org. You can do it online or at 1-888-345-9499.
You know, Joanne, what's so exciting about things here at WHYY is while a lot of news organizations have had to make cutbacks, we've expanded our services in New Jersey. We've expanded our news department. We have a very vibrant online presence. Lots of things going on here, taking advantage of some of these technological advances, many different ways that you can listen to information and news programs like Radio Times. And we're very excited about expanding our services in New Jersey. We were able to do that because we knew that there was listener support there. We love the fact that you listen to programs like Radio Times. We want you to make that next step. It's not going to bankrupt you. You know you listen. You know the programs cost money. We have to buy programs and pay people and cover the electric bill at WHYY. That is where your money goes. So do pick up that phone just a couple of minutes before the end of Radio Times. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. We count each and every call. And as Joanne says, we're looking for $10,000 during this break. We're almost halfway there, about $3,900, and certainly time to make that call.
And if you can afford a $1,000
sure
pledge, call us, 1-888-345-9499. If it's a little less than that, call us, 1-888-345-9499. Why not a $200 pledge for the green combo? It's the WHYY water bottle, grocery bag, and travel mug. Do your part to keep WHYY strong and to recycle. 1-888-345-9499.
There's a nice hubbub here. We're hearing people on the phone, and we like that, and we appreciate the fact that there's so many people willing to volunteer their time and come down here and answer those phone calls. We want you to take advantage of that as well by making a call right now. We're not at our goal yet, and we want to make our goal.